Hello, everyone. Thank you for coming. We're going to start the panel in a second now. And my name is Eric Stoyer. I'm the creative director of Creative Commons. And we're going to first just go down the line here and talk about who we are briefly, give the quick pitch in, I guess, 30 seconds, and talk about what you do, what your company does, and then we'll go from there. Start over there with John.
So my name is John Buckman. I'm the founder of Magnatune.com. We're an online record label that licenses music online to films and ads and all sorts of other uses.
My name's Glenn. I am a lawyer at YouTube. I'm a products counsel, which means I advise like engineers and product managers and stuff like that. I'm not really a litigator, not really a deal person. I used to work at Creative Commons and Google.
My name is Lori Racine. I sit on the board of Creative Commons. I'm in the SVP for biz dev for a company called iSpot, a video remix and distribution company. And I'm a co-founder of a company called DotSub, which is looking into subtitling on the fly videos of all kinds. And I also sit on a bunch of boards related to independent and documentary film. I'll talk louder. This may also not be.
And I'm Max Shore. I'm the publisher and founding editor of Good Magazine. And Good is part of a new startup media company. We do a magazine, films, online video, and events. Oh, thanks. And and so we're just launching, and that's cool.
Okay, so this panel is broadly about open content, remixing, and how those concepts affect things like ownership and getting paid. So, the question I'm asked a lot when I tell people I'm from Creative Commons is, wait, so how do people actually make money doing stuff like this? And maybe you could talk about your experience with John, because your whole business model is sort of based around this idea of being a bit more flexible about copyright. And so maybe a success story or two, or just broadly about how your business works.
Okay, so Magnatune acts in a way like a traditional record label. What we do is we get artists who submit CDs, and the ones we love, we pick, we market, we sell, and we sell them on the website. We sell downloads and CDs, and we also license the music. The Creative Commons angle is that all the music that's on the site is available under Creative Commons non-commercial share-alike license. What that means is you can use the music for free as long as your use is itself non-commercial, and the work you create is also under the same Creative Commons license. So that broadly means that if you're not going to make any money from our music in your work, then it's totally cool to use it. Where that turns into money is you can hit the license button on the website at Magnatune, and 14 scenarios pop up, everything from advertising to website and film. And you can just license the music and it's pre-cleared. So what we find, for example, for filmmakers is filmmakers, before they have a distribution deal, will use our music for free in their film, screen it for free, show it. And then if for some reason they get picked up, which is of course their dream, then they can get automatically a license for it. And we don't ask to look at the film. It's automatically approved. That has turned out really well. Over 4 years, we've licensed over 1,000 films. And of those 1,000 films, 2 of them have gotten worldwide distribution, which gives you an idea of how many really go there. The license for festival usage is $40. So it's awfully cheap to just get a legal license and off you go. There have been lots and lots of cases that are interesting. Some I sort of stay away from the big names, because every once in a while someone gets a big deal and it's not that useful to the people in this room. So just 3 examples I'll give. One is Lonely Girl 15, uses our music as well as music from CC Mixter and other internet music. About 1/4 of the episodes so far of Lonely Girl 15 have used Magnatune music. And on YouTube, every episode that they use our music, they tag it with Magnatune and they credit it. And that's been just tremendously valuable. They also, it was kind of funny. I was at the Lonely Girl 15 panel, earlier, and at the end of the panel, someone came up and pitched them on, hey, how do you get music for Lonely Girl 15? And the guy started pitching Magnatune to them. And it's not like I pay Lonely Girl 15 to do that. They're just fans of what we do, and they like what we do. The person was really unhappy to hear that, because they were a music supervisor who was pitching Lonely Girl 15. But that's one example of free advertising and helping out people who don't have any money, help them build their careers. And then when they do have some money, they'll come back to you. The people who did the Blair Witch Project are very interesting. They did another film called The Strand, which was an episodic series, sort of soap opera series set in California. And they avoided distribution completely. Something to keep in mind is when you hear the word distribution, it sounds like a great thing. But really what distribution is a sale of rights. And you're selling your rights away so someone else can then try and make money off of that. But if the film doesn't do well, you've sold your rights, and that's that, and you've lost a lot of flexibility. There are now so many other ways to get your film used than to try and show it on a screen and get people to sit in chairs and watch it. Think about whether distribution is the right way to go. The Strand thought about it quite seriously, and these are the Blair Witch people, and they don't have any trouble getting distribution. What they did is they did a series of shows that they released on a weekly basis and a screen on the web, and you can go and watch them for free. But because it's a soap opera, there's drama and tension, and all the while there's a DVD. So if you didn't want to wait the weeks until the episodes came out, you could just buy the DVD. Of course, there's extras, but also it wasn't a little 1-inch by 2-inch screen. And they did phenomenally well with that. And they went with us because they went to the major labels and they all said, oh, free video, that's theft. We don't want to get involved in that. So it's commercial license, but they like the more open rights thing. Finally, a film called Star Wreck, that's W-R-E-C-K, made by 3,000 people in Finland. It's the most successful internet full-length film of all time. And it's a parody of Star Trek and Babylon 5. It's kind of a mashup. And over 3,000 people cooperated on this thing. It took them years. And they put a Creative Commons license on it so people could watch it for free, pass it around. It was and is tremendously successful, over 5 million downloads, and they sell DVDs of it. They recently got a deal with Paramount that now is screening their movie in Europe and also for DVD rights. And interestingly enough, Paramount gave them extra funding to change the special effects slightly so they look slightly less like Star Trek, so that there wouldn't be any copyright issues. So those are some examples that are kind of interesting of alternative rights approaches to getting some money for your film.
Glenn, I wanted to ask you, because you're at YouTube right now and you've also been on Creative Commons team, so you may have an interesting perspective on this. So, you know, how do big companies, how can they kind of move forward in using content like this without exploiting the participants of this culture?
Without exploiting, sorry?
The participants, the people.
Well, so there's a few examples starting to come up of, I mean, you see it informally in a lot of different places, more and more kind of media companies and studios who are inviting kind of user participation, and they keep it under pretty limited terms. You're starting to see more examples, I guess, of major media companies, you know, record labels, movie studios, et cetera, agreeing to allow users to do more with their stuff, provided that someone is paying for it. Maybe the users aren't paying directly for it, but that the services where they're approving of kind of more interactivity are paying for it, and that they get some measure of kind of control over what's happening on there. And it's a slow process, but that said, there's been some pretty significant deals in the last couple of years with just a couple of the YouTube examples, three major labels and YouTube basically coming to deals that include the ability for users to use major label music for free in their YouTube videos and that sort of thing, which is, you know, probably a bigger step. It's a step in the direction that seems maybe for most of us like letting go or ceding some control or that sort of thing than they've done in the past. So there's definitely models out there. I think that one of the questions that comes up is that you got to keep in mind there's like a three-way economy going on. You've got the people who produce the content. Well, there's four actually, really. You've got the artists who make the stuff, the people who are originally distributing it for them, the services like YouTube that are intermediaries, and then the end users. And everybody kind of wants a piece right now. And so there's a lot of different possibilities for who actually pays for what thing. And the people who benefit from it may not be the ones paying for it.
Can I add just something?
Please do.
And just to add to that, I think one of the things that's happening is you're seeing two distinct parallel paradigms emerging from the traditional media companies, knowing that they want to play, knowing that they have something both to gain and to lose. Many of them are looking for ways to attract audiences by creating vehicles for strictly user-generated content and alternative vehicles for mashing and remixing of their own content against their own content. And they have perhaps different rules for these two different communities. But eventually, my suggestion is they will converge. It's just it will take time because there is such a huge change in thinking that is now being required of the traditional media companies. And in terms of people who are making user-generated content, they have the opportunity to now play in just so many different ballparks that I think the world will really eventually move towards UGC stuff.
Max, maybe you could talk a bit about how your magazine, you know, sort of uses this approach and why that was part of the idea behind the magazine.
Definitely. Good Magazine uses a Creative Commons license with all of our authors. And it is something that just, it felt like the norm growing up to us. It's like, we are, a young startup media company and, we totally support creatives and people making this content. So the sort of norm is like, okay, we want to create a situation where the contributors have control. Like our mecca, our sweet spot is getting to a place where we have this wonderful platform where we have, a great pool of contributors to go to, and they really know their rights. They're creating things that they love, really amazing content about stuff that matters. And we can pay them a lot of money for that. So right now we just pay people the same that we would pay them for a normal, more exclusive copyright, but we sort of really do our best to educate our contributors about their rights and create a situation where they can, use the work that they make to help spread the word for themselves and for us.
Are there any kind of emerging companies or models that you guys have noticed that you think are interesting that are using this approach in a way that people maybe don't know about? John?
I mean, I talked about a couple, but I mean, in general, in the music world, I'm advising all musicians to basically license rights to other people. No longer give rights away. Don't lose rights. Do a limited term plan thing, and as much as possible, work in a non-exclusive capacity. In the film world, there are now so many interesting things that you can do. I mean, besides getting your videos up on YouTube, Rever. Rever's interesting. It's a site where you can send your video, and at the end there's a commercial, and they distribute for free. And one thing that's nice is the video quality is far superior to what YouTube does. But there are a number of instances where people have made in the range of $20,000 or $30,000 off advertising off Rever, which is, indie film level interest. I love this idea of what's the end. Give a teaser away. And there are, Podio Books is an interesting site where authors read their own books, then you subscribe to it, and every week you get the next chapter. And by giving stuff for free, but under sort of limited terms, right, you have to wait to get the next chapter or the quality isn't as good. This is kind of the old shareware model of letting people try and pass it around and get a really honest evaluation of it and then paying if they want the next level up. And then a whole host of models around letting the people who have no money use your product anyway. And then how do you differentiate that? But if you can figure out ways to do that, either by offering a lower quality good, like a lower quality film, or sticking a non-commercial license on it or some other thing. On Magnitude, for example, our audio is streamed rather than downloaded, which encourages people to listen to it. But it's a limitation. People who really like it want something on CD or they want an MP3 on their hard disk. So those are the most interesting models I see are those that straddle the world of free and pay in a way that moves people a lot closer. They're getting a lot more than normally would have gotten for free, but they still see that last value. And I guess the last thing is people really like ethical capitalism. They really want their money to go into things. In fact, this is kind of the foundation of Good Magazine, to go into things that they really believe in. And whether it's buying cosmetics that don't torture little bunnies or record labels that actually pay musicians and don't cause them to commit suicide. These are ways they want to spend their money. And I think it's the same thing with films. If you go to Magnitude, just as one example, every page at Magnitude has a facial, a picture close-up of the musician looking at you in your eyes. And I think there are enough filmmakers doing that, saying, hey, this is my film. I made this thing. This is who I am. Support me, support what I do, and I'll do more of this.
I also think that's one of the things at iSpot.com. One of the things we encourage is for filmmakers, whether you're an individual filmmaker or whether you're part of a studio system, to come and for free put your stuff up on iSpot and allow other people to remix it. So what you're trying to do is you're trying to grow a creative community. It's a great way, it's a great marketing tool, and it's also a great way to expand the whole creative process. So it's your work, and then it's your work being to the nth degree. And as that continues to grow, that will add to a whole body of work, of creative work, and also add to, you know, it's a buzz builder, it's a marketing machine, and it doesn't cost anything. And, you know, I think what you get back from it is more audience.
Something I hear said a lot at South by Southwest, which means me fundamentally wrong. People ask the question, how do I break into the big industry? Whether it's I need to get film X to hear my music or distributor Y to see my film. And fundamentally, I think that's just not the right approach. I think fundamentally, if you're the little guy and they're the big guy, your chances are really tiny and you're just thinking about this all wrong. If you want to help yourself, you need to find other small people who need you too. So if you're a musician trying to break into film music, find other budding filmmakers who need music and vice versa. Find people who need to remix your music. If you need to find distributors, find the little art house theaters that need interesting stuff so they can differentiate themselves. Find the small people. Don't try and break into big media. You won't succeed. You'll only succeed once you break into the smaller levels. The big media people are interested in seeing that you're a real go-getter and you've broken in to a smaller level and there's a grassroots support to it.
And small can be huge, and small can be really beautiful too. And I think the most powerful thing is something small that's done just right. You know, and I want to see, you know, a million little masterpieces. Like, everyone here in this room can make a masterpiece. And sometimes I think of like Larry Bird shooting hoops in the rain in Indiana, like before anyone knew about him, but he probably wasn't missing too much. And like, we might not be able to shoot like that, but like, everyone can do something really, really cool. And if you do that thing in a really small, in a really beautiful way, there's increasingly, you know, democratized means of distribution. So you can put that thing up and people can see it. And that's what I want to see. And I think we're going to start seeing a lot more of that. And so that's really exciting. So small people, yeah, getting together, making their masterpieces, and then who knows where it happens, you know?
Yeah. And of course, as indie filmmakers, you're often aiming at vertical audiences who just aren't being served by anybody else.
There's a great movie being made in New York, and the filmmaker is escaping me and I'm totally embarrassed, but it's an open source movie about the street Broadway. And what this guy did, David Todd, are you in the room? Yeah, who did it, though? Okay, sorry. Basically, what he did last May is he advertised this, and 200-some-odd filmmakers came out with cameras, and they went up and down Broadway, which is 242 blocks long, essentially, and documented stories of people on the street and people who had the history of Broadway. And they've put this together, and they're editing it now, and they're essentially going to keep retelling these stories and allow this to have a real viral effect. When it comes out, and I hope I'm not betraying his trust, but I believe it will come out this May. It will be the beginning of a yearly look at the stories that have made New York on Broadway. It's not just Broadway, the theatrical district. It's Broadway down from the financial district up into Harlem. And the idea is unbelievable. And this is all about free culture, remixed culture, and open environments. So look for it. It's called Broadway, I guess, or the street Broadway. I'm not sure.
Can I ask just a question to the people on the panel who work? I don't work directly with people creating original stuff in deals and stuff like that. So what do you, for people who haven't already gotten religion or gotten experimental like this filmmaker with trying out, to some degree or another, ceding some control, you know, practically in your experience, what have been the sticking points when you are pitching something like an open license to someone whose content you're going to get? What are the sticking points and how do you get them around that? Or how hard do you push to get them around that? Because there seems to be some like tension in For any kind of open licensing to be meaningful, it has to really stick, right? It can't be just kind of like we agree to look the other way, though that happens all over the place. But to make something really stick, you have to be willing to, as the artist, give up some control, right? So what are the kind of resistance do you see to it on a practical level, on a daily basis? And then, you know, what kind of ways do you use to get people to make that compromise or make the leap of faith?
Well, it's kind of like hiring people right out of college. They don't yet have a clue how hard life is, and no one really cares whether they succeed or not. And it's like that when you deal with a musician with their first album. Often they think, oh, I don't want to do an open license. I don't want to be downloadable on the internet. I want to wait for the record label that's going to get me the babes, the booze, the limo, and the drugs. And we let them flounder out there for a few years, and then they come back and they go, you know, no one's going to do this for me. I have to do it for myself. And, you know, I got 45 downloads for my album last year. I guess that wasn't really worth it. Maybe I'll put an open license on my last album, and then I'll put a closed license on my new one, because the new one's really the good one. And then suddenly the old one does a lot better, and they go, that doesn't seem to work. So, I mean, generally, it's kind of an awakening process that you just got to work it, and the world doesn't care about you. You've got to go out there and engage it fully and give people something they want. And the thing about the Creative Commons license and the other licenses is it's really making a point about the audience saying, I'm going to give you rights. I'm going to let you use this, remix it, and give you freedoms that big media doesn't. And that feels good. And it makes people want to give things back to you. And I mean, today, if you want to make something of yourself, you got to get blogged. You got to be on MySpace. You have to get the world essentially to do things for you. You need that friends network. And they're only going to do that for you if they believe in you. So open licensing is part of going out to the audience and making that possible. But often it's not possible on the first deal. They have to get a little bit of life experience and see that no one cares, and they're going to have to be a little more trusting.
And from our end with the magazine, there hasn't been much resistance so far. I mean, we're so new that we're still figuring it all out. But part of it is, you know, Creative Commons and Colette Vogel, who's our lawyer, who's drafted these contracts, has made it so accessible. And we provide a human readable version of the contract, which is really healthy. Like, you know, if you're a writer and you have like 30 pages of like this contract, it's kind of scary to sign it, but still working.
Hey, Max, correct me if I'm wrong, but in the magazine business, traditionally writers have lost the rights to the article. They sell the rights to the article and they get kind of a pittance of a payment. And you're coming back and saying, no, we're going to actually put it on open license and there's going to be reuse possible. That's like a better deal. Why wouldn't they go for it?
Yeah. I mean, it varies. Photographers oftentimes, have, you know, they have all the control, and writers oftentimes lose all the control, but it varies. And I don't have much expertise on the
okay. So photographers might be less happy with what you're doing, but the writers are more happy. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Well, what's the argument? So if I'm an artist and I want to do something with one of your companies or I want to get on MySpace, I realize that the internet is, I have to be on the internet. I have to be on MySpace. I have to have a blog. I want the MP3 blogs to have my songs on them, but I kind of think like I like the idea of I like to make the calls as I see them. I don't want to try and guess in advance what uses I want people to make of my work. I'll just go ahead and put it up there, and copyright lets me, you know, when I see a use I don't like, cut it down, take it down, get it, you know, sue somebody if I have to. What's the argument for, I mean, why should I try and formalize what exactly I want people to do with my stuff in advance if this stuff is happening all over the place? I mean, every band has a MySpace page and every band puts their MP3s up there. And they know that they're not giving up all control. They know that if Ford takes their song and syncs it up to a TV commercial, they can sue Ford. Like, what are they getting out of formalizing? And I'm saying this as I wear a Creative Commons t-shirt because I used to work there. But for the sake of argument, what actually am I – why would I make that extra step?
Okay. So for the – I'll call this the documentarian's dilemma. How many people here are documentarians? Okay. So one of the biggest problems for documentary filmmakers is – having access to other people's footage to include in their work. And the second big problem is what will become of their work when somebody else wants to use it. So it's the balance between access and control that Creative Commons makes clear. It allows one to have a better understanding of what permissions one is granting to one's work. And if archival footage was released, re-released under Creative Commons license, it would allow people the ability to use that work to make great new work without having to pay exorbitant amounts of money in order to be able to use, you know, 15 seconds of a clip from a movie that was made 40 years ago.
I mean, the Magnitude argument is very simple, which is just non-commercial use drives commercial use. And we see that time and time again. So by putting out your music or film or whatever with a much more open reuse, copying friendly license, it'll just get far more distribution and has a much greater chance of being seen. But tangibly what that means is people will incorporate your work in their work. Some of those people will make money and they will then have to get a commercial license from you in order to be legal. And they generally can't be showing their stuff, for example, on TV unless they have a full clearance. And this happens all the time for us. So many of these films, so many of these websites start off non-commercial. I mean, many people might know the term temp track love, which is when music gets synced on a film because there's no other music yet available. We put a temporary track in there. Oh, let's just grab something from this foolish label Magnitude that lets me download. And we'll just cut it and we'll get that real good Aerosmith song when we actually get to it. And then 2 weeks before the festival, in fact, there was a film at South By that called us just a few weeks ago that they couldn't get clearance on the real song they were going to put in. And, you know, so they just wrote a check and they had clearance. And that happens all the time. And they wouldn't have considered us because they were, you know, they had a real film budget and a real music budget. And they were going to put a real band in there. But actually what happened is they had this and they really wanted to find something else. And, of course, they had fallen. It's called Temp Track Love. Because they've heard this song and they visualize the scene over and over with our music and it's perfect now because that's how they see it. So there's that. And then there's things like Lonely Girl 15 and you know, just getting out there. The biggest one though is actually what I would call business development, which is all these websites that need content for their idea. And it's stuff like Last.fm that needs to play music. It's stuff like WebJ where people point at music playlists on the internet. iRate is a collaborative radio station. It's stuff like CC Mixter, which is a remix site. I mean, there's just dozens of websites that someone comes up with a cool idea and they can't do it with RIA Music. So they go, okay, how am I going to do this? Oh, I can use CC Music. Okay, well, I can get all this music for reuse. And they're simply not going to call the band that doesn't have a CC license and say, dude, can I negotiate a license with you? And, you know, my lawyer, I guess I'll go hire one. We'll talk to your lawyer when you hire one. That's not going to happen. So it just, no one likes lawyers except the big media people. So this just gets rid of all the lawyers, which is just... Yeah, I mean, actually, YouTube is a great example of a really good idea gone horribly wrong. And let me explain what I mean is clearly, you know,
Here's the tension on the panel.
That's right. Clearly, you know, people really want something like YouTube. And YouTube said, well, the only way we can do this is just to say, well, screw copyright. Let's just go do it and see who sues us. And then, hey, dude, no one's suing us. What's the deal? And then, dude, we got an offer from Google, but we got all these lawsuits in here. And it says we have to reserve a third of what Google's giving us to defend ourselves. Dude, what's up with that?
Might as well, since we are getting into the dramatic part of the panel. I don't know where, so one is all these lawsuits, there's one lawsuit. So
okay.
Let's clear that up. And I don't know where you're getting the information about a third, so I'd be interested in the source.
The rumor mill.
Yeah, exactly.
The blogosphere.
Cool.
So, but, I mean, if I have to get into it, I mean, like, okay, the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, makes very clear that basically, it is up to copyright holders to say what is authorized or not, and to take stuff down if they see stuff that's not authorized. And the fact is, a lot of people don't sue because a lot of people are at least tacitly authorizing the use of their stuff online, and they want it to be that way. And their marketing departments put their stuff up. Maybe their lawyers don't know in some cases. Maybe they do. A lot of times, the artists put their own stuff up. There's no way right now for intermediary sites to know what is an authorized use or not when something goes up. It's not like porn. It's not like a beheading video, which when you see it, you know it's porn or a beheading video. There is no visible element to something to know whether or not it has been authorized by the copyright holder. Unless, you know, Creative Commons takes over the world. And then there'll be a little double C on things you know that are authorized. And that assumes that everyone uses it. So, you know, until we have that, until Creative Commons takes over the world, or until everyone starts using it, the most efficient way for this kind of thing to happen is to rely on the DMCA to basically let copyright holders make the choice. And a lot of them are making the choice, and a lot of them are kind of taking a while to make up their mind as to whether or not they want stuff up or they want stuff down, or they want to experiment with the promotional effects of letting users basically like crowdsourcing the distribution and getting more buzz out of it. So I don't know. It's a big question in all this stuff is, what are the alternative proposals for how you turbocharge user-generated content and all the benefits of it? But I don't know exactly what your alternative proposal is, but I'd be happy to hear it.
I guess what I'm trying to say about YouTube is it's something obviously the public really, really wants, and it's not economical to do copyright clearance on every submission. It just totally doesn't work. So the YouTube people said, well, since that's not going to work, we're going to go ahead and use the DMCA and just wait till basically we get lawsuit threats, you know, takedown notices, and that's how we're going to deal with this.
There's a huge difference between a lawsuit threat and a takedown notice.
Fair enough. Takedown notice is a legal notice that you should remove it. And that's a way to deal with that. But a different way to go about it is to do it in a legal fashion where the copyright holders are into it. And that's stuff like iSpot. That's totally Creative Commons. And, you know, they don't get takedown notices daily telling them that it's all legal and that you should know better. But there is at least a perception in the media that big media, the copyright holders in video, aren't entirely pleased with YouTube and are unsure what their next strategy is going to be, whether they're going to negotiate license fees with you, whether they're going to take you to court. It certainly wasn't done in partnership with them.
Well, one thing that's interesting that we're seeing is that, it certainly is being done in partnership with them. You've got three major labels with deals with YouTube. You've got a couple of broadcast networks with deals with YouTube. You've got hundreds of studios and channels that have directors' channels on YouTube. So it is being done in partnership. What we're seeing, though, is that I think we can kind of no longer refer to big media as one thing with one attitude. I think you're seeing individual big media companies making individual decisions and taking their time to do so. Some get to it quick, like Warner Brothers Records. They understood fast that user-generated content was the future and got a deal with YouTube early on. Some are still trying to figure out how to do it, but it's being done in partnership with some big media companies, which is trying to be done in partnership with all big media companies, but they have their rights and they have their options and they're taking their time to make up their minds. But it's no longer, I think, single-minded industry. That's what's pretty interesting right now.
I think that's what I was trying to get to earlier, that this revolution or this evolutionary process is beginning to take place, and how long it takes is unclear, but the direction is towards openness. I think that's the take-home message.
Do companies have a responsibility to be open? I mean, the term is sort of a buzzword now that gets bandied about without any sort of real definition. So as it becomes more nebulous, is there sort of a do we need to define what it even is? Do we need to hold companies, towards being responsible and being
right?
Open?
I mean, the slogan for Magnitude is "We are not evil," which is a bit broader than open. Though open is part of that. And you know, there are, if you want the world to blog you and to love you, it's certainly going to help. I mean, there was a big horrible to do when MySpace's music license came out. And people started reading, and it looked like when you upload music to MySpace, MySpace owns that music and can exploit it in full. And that certainly wasn't what people's perception of MySpace was, and they didn't go with an open license. And in fact, that's one of the pitches I give when people say, well, why should I use Creative Commons for idea of business X, is you don't want to wake up one day and your discussion boards are going line by line through your use agreement and unhappy with all sorts of provisions in it. So,
yeah. I think that's a really good point. And I think that's something that's really interesting and weird and cool about that actually happens. You do get people going through use agreements line by line by line. And when there is something that's unclear in your terms of use, it ends up on boing boing and there's a furor until you clarify, okay, we meant this. I mean, I think that's great, actually. I mean, I think that's exactly in the spirit of what like Creative Commons is trying to do, is make things more human readable as opposed to lawyer readable. It's a really interesting question. Like, is there a responsibility of companies to be open? If you mean that in the sense of like norms or ethical stuff, then I think that, yeah, I think so. And I think that it's good to apply pressure to companies to think about this stuff. And I think that's what John's referring to. in terms of it's good in the sense of it's good for business, it's good for customer relations, it's good for your artists, et cetera. I'm reluctant to try and to say that to take the extra step of saying that it should be some sort of legal responsibility of companies to be open. I mean, I think that at least properly interpreted, a lot of the copyright laws, again, at least properly interpreted, at least a lot of the copyright laws allow for a lot of default openness. I mean, fair use, when interpreted correctly, works pretty well for that sort of thing. And I worry that if you start trying to mandate it, though that's not exactly what you proposed, if you start trying to mandate openness on the part of companies or mandate that they lose control in certain ways that they're not now, then you see a backlash. And basically they control the formation of laws a lot more efficiently than the rest of us do. And that backlash will have serious consequences.
Far be it for me to try to mandate openness, just for the record. Anyone else have any responses? Or
I was just going to say, I think it is a responsibility of the company, or I think it should be, to be transparent about the way you do things. I think that is a responsibility that then enables consumers to really, you know, pull that company in the direction that they want. So I think the company's responsibilities are to their customers and also the stakeholders. But I think there really should be more and more demands for transparency so that, you know, if the customers want to pull people in that direction, they can.
The interesting thing about transparency is even if when many companies are attempting to be transparent, the amount of legalese that ends up going into these user agreements is just off-putting. For example, how mm-hmm. many people here have uploaded video to any one of a number of video or photo hosting sites and never read the user agreement? I mean, you know, yeah. Right. Right. So the challenge becomes is
shame on you all.
Or you want to do, you know, you want to be open, you want to be transparent in the best of circumstances. Then how do you make that into six sentences?
I think you do. I think that one of the coolest things that Creative Commons did I guess it was originally Lessig's idea was this idea of having different levels of a license that you have. A human readable version of the license, which is basically like a bunch of icons that look like the international symbols for like toilets and hospitals and airports that you see. That everybody can recognize, yes, that means no derivative works. At least over time, people recognize that. Not quite as instinctually as, like, I'm choking or something like that. But we're getting there. We're getting there. I think that's a great thing. And you see that. And I think you see that sort of trend, like having the summary of the license and then a link through to the full license in things like, I mean, Google's doing that with our privacy policies now, where products will have sort of a privacy summary with the major big points, the things that people care about the most, the things that are the big points that are in bold, and then you can link through to the details. And I think that that's something that should be done with a bunch of different kinds of things like end user license agreements, and I think that would be really, really cool.
Yeah, see, the interesting thing about that is that even for Creative Commons and, you know, certainly I drank the Kool-Aid when Larry Lessig was drawing this on a napkin, that taking it from the iconic stage and having, for example, the filmmakers, because this is what I know the most about, understand what a non-commercial license means is still difficult. And so even though we're working towards that, we're still stuck to a certain degree, at least from my personal perspective in working with filmmakers.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. And explain a little bit why those end user license agreements are so complicated is you're trying to basically use language that will describe every situation known to man. And you have to cover that in a sentence. It's not going to be possible to do in a sentence, right? So, I mean, non-commercial use, great example. What the hell do we mean by non-commercial use? That's a term that all of us have used a bunch of times in this panel, but like that people vary a lot on what they think non-commercial use is, right? And if you get down the road of like saying, okay, non-commercial use means you're actually selling my thing. Okay, that's one example. If you start enumerating different examples, then you have the risk of leaving out other things you haven't thought of yet. And I mean, I think that's to a certain extent, like, unfortunately, uncertainty is going to be inevitable. Uncertainty, what you're facing is uncertainty or a long ass EULA. That's like kind of like that you won't read. So you're back to uncertainty, I guess.
I want to gauge quickly how many questions in the audience there might be. You raise your hand. So there's a good amount. So I think we'll actually segue into that now. This is being recorded for podcast, so if you could get up and ask your question at the mic there, I guess form a line. That was done without even my prompting. So you're first. Guy first in line.
A lot of people have considered the idea of whether this non-commercial use is even a good idea to promote. Like that there's such a blurry line in the licensing and what you can use for, and that in certain from certain people's political perspectives, including a lot of my own, I mean, there isn't even really a line to be drawn. Like people's lives are so integrated with their finances that, I mean, whether I'm making a buck off of it or nothing is kind of shaky. And that we're really creating a world of content that is commonly licensed under non-commercial, and that is just pushing back the line instead of really reforming what we have now. That now another chunk can remix the content, but it's still just drawing a firm line.
So, I mean, do you mind if I put on my Creative Commons hat for that one and my old Creative Commons hat, tattered and unused?
You never get out.
Yeah, never get out. I think that, I mean, I'm glad you mentioned that it's political, because I think that ultimately is a political question, actually, because it's basically a question about, like, it doesn't have to necessarily put principle and effectiveness in tension, but I think it does. It's basically a question of, like, do you want kind of open content to be a hardline party or a big tent party? And I think that for things like software, having maybe a hardline party might be more effective. It might, there you might get principle and effectiveness dovetailing well, right? With things like basically like GPL and things that allow commercial use and don't draw boundaries and things like that. But I think that's because you have a lot more in the area of norms and attitudes, a lot more agreement to begin with. When you move into the area of like culture or content, you've got like a whole lot of people with a whole lot of wildly different attitudes, and trying to get photographers to agree with bloggers, to agree with DJs, to agree with filmmakers on what they think should be an appropriate use is really hard. And so I think that the Creative Commons way was to say, if you just poll people, you're going to get disagreement about whether or not they would allow their stuff to be used commercially. And then if you poll those people, you're going to get disagreement about what kinds of commercial uses you're going to do. And so the idea was, well, we want to be a big tent party because we think that's the way to be more effective in the area of culture or content. And so give people the choices and then collect the data. And the data says that people who use Creative Commons licenses, a lot of them like the non-commercial provision and wouldn't use it without it, right? But we don't impose it on everybody, right? Or we, God, there I go into it again. They don't impose it on everybody. So I think that that's, I think it's ultimately, it is a kind of political strategic thing as much as it is a philosophical one.
Next.
So first, I'd like to say this is a great panel. It's a very lively but civilized and honest conversation. It's probably the best one I've been in. So thank you guys for that.
Now you're going to slaughter us with a question, aren't
no,
you?
No. No, I'm not. Yeah.
That's it.
You specifically, Mr. Brown. No, so my company makes podcasting devices, and I'll be remiss if I don't say it, boxpopuli.com if anyone wants to see it. And so we're selling primarily to colleges and universities. And so they generally don't want access to their content. Professors don't want their content put up there because they're afraid that if it's up there then and they don't have tenure, they're not going to be any reason they need to hire them back the next year. Universities want to make sure that only people that pay for those courses are in, you know, have access to that. But, you know, I think there's obviously like an incredible opportunity for open content, especially educational, because if it's remixed and reused, I mean, that content is good content as opposed to, last year it seemed like people were talking about cat videos. This year it's like fart videos are the ones that are really popular, and that may be the trend. But the point is educational content is really great. So, is there a difference? Why would you tell like a college to license under an open license? I mean, I think that is the way that what they should do, but I don't know if there's a good reason that I could give them. So I want you to give me that reason.
Probably the first thing I'd ask is are you a for-profit or are you a state-sponsored education? And then that your mission kind of varies. If you're a state-sponsored, then obviously your mission is probably to educate your population by whatever most effective means you have to spend the money. And that's going to be open license, at the very least within your country borders.
But even a public university is still going to have to be, you know, have to get tuition. They're going to still have to be under the same.
Yes and no. I mean, the issue is they get money in a bunch of ways, right? They're going to get money from the government. They're going to get tuition money. I mean, most state sponsored schools are overwhelmingly sponsored by government money and the tuition is a small amount. But it depends all over the place. It's going to be an evaluation. I mean, I've dealt I had long talks with the Open University folks in the UK about this, and the big anxiety really is MIT, because you've got this massive brand with damn good professors. I mean, no one's going to say they got better people than MIT, except maybe Harvard is going to say that, but no one else is going to say that. And they're already open content. So the competition's already better than you. And there was a survey, and maybe you guys can verify this. The year after MIT went open content, they surveyed the incoming class to ask them what was the top reason you had for applying to MIT. And 30% says the open courseware was their top reason. And these are people who are paying the crazy fees to go into MIT. So clearly they wanted to go to places that were open. That was part of what they wanted to endorse with their time. And just like I was saying, you know, with Magnitude or Body Shop or any of these businesses, people spend their money in a way that they think is going to help change the world. And openness is something that is seen as a good thing, and people want to spend their money and be educated at open places.
Well, also OpenCourseWare has initiated other institutions to join this huge consortium that also just embraces OpenCourseWare. And I would suggest you call the Hewlett Foundation, which is sponsoring and has spent tens of millions of dollars on what's called open education resources. And they are a great resource and source for everything related to open content.
Yeah, I think that's a fantastic idea. I was extremely frustrated. I was teaching high school level writing to inner city kids and Native American students in my former job before starting the magazine. And I was like hamstrung by, I actually broke the law to like teach poetry to some of these kids because, like, I could
rad
photocopy.
See, that's
but
commitment
like,
to poetry.
It's a great idea to be able to do that. So.
The man at the Creative Commons just wanted to know if you had an idea how many of the folks who actually use the Creative Commons license actually register with the U.S. Copyright Office. I know there's some different protections, and also I wanted to know what the panel thought about the possibility of some content like music being a public utility. And what you thought about the possibility of that actually being a viable alternative, because as we know, DRM basically doesn't work as effectively.
I have no idea how many people register their copyright with the government, because you know what we do, and sort of I think one of the cool things that we do is just provide a tool, and then we don't keep track of, you know, what you're doing and who you are. It's more a legal tool that anyone can use for free, and it's just you come use it and then do your thing. You know. That said, I don't know how many people understand that when you create something, you actually own the copyright automatically. You don't need to assert it by registering with the government. So, we tell people that pretty frequently, and people are generally surprised to know that. So, I really don't have any information about that, though. Yeah. So.
I would suspect very few, since the protection you get from registering is fairly minor. We tell people not to bother. Instead, burn a CD and mail it to yourself, and don't open the envelope. And the reason that that works is then if you need to assert your copyright on a certain date, it'll be opened in the court as you having created that work on that date.
I guess I was just thinking when you register with the Federal Copyright Office, you can file for an injunction, and you can't do that.
That's right. It does help you with lawsuits, but you can file also if you've mailed it to yourself, you've got then backdated proof of you having created that work, and that just costs a stamp.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely benefits to registering. Like, you can get an injunction. It's actually a prerequisite to suing someone to have registered. And you can get, though this is, depends on whose chair you're sitting in, a good thing or not. You're more able to get things like statutory damages, which means higher numbers for if you actually win.
I think it's about $35, right?
To register?
Yeah.
The statutory damages are totally out of proportion to any real damage that goes on, but in most cases, but that is a benefit from it. But again, like Eric said, registration is no longer a prerequisite to having a copyright. And I want to address your second point about music being a public utility. I mean, there are some ideas. I think they're pretty much just in the realm of academics and like hardcore public policy right now about trying to do things like not so much consider music a public utility, but consider copyright regulation in that kind of blanket fashion where you would basically tax ISPs or users as sort of a connectivity tax and then spread the rights collection across different works, sort of doing on a macro level what people like ASCAP BMI do in certain sub parts of the industry. I think it's suffice to say is that right now those remain hardcore public policy and academic ideas.
Yeah, I'm seriously against that. There's a book called The Future of Music by Gerd Leonhardt that is sort of the main testament to this music like water idea. And first of all, ASCAP and BMI are so heavily biased against the small person. They use literally different calculations. If you sell more than 120,000 albums or less than 120,000, if you're in less than, you're in the global pool where you get divided up and not even tracked individually, despite the fact that computers can track individually. So the whole idea of a blanket tax that would then go to some meta-governmental agency. The French actually have seriously considered this as a solution to the RIA coming in and suing all their citizens. They were talking about, and it almost passed, a levy on every citizen that used the internet, and then it would be paid out. The French really like this because it turns out they already do this for, they collect a right for arranger, so whoever arranges music in France, and they keep the money. It gets divided among French filmmakers. That's what funds French film, is the composer royalty. So, you know, governments getting getting huge amounts of money and they're supposed to flow back to little people, you can bet that's going to get tapped a whole bunch of times. And then when it doesn't get tapped, it's going to be go out to whoever buys them off.
And another, if you're interested in the subject, and it sounds like you know a lot about it already, but if other people are interested in the subject, there's a book called Promises to Keep by Terry Fisher, who's a law professor at Harvard that explores that idea at length.
Can I just say something off the subject? Eric just handed me something. The name of the filmmaker of A Broadway is Robert Liano. So please go look for the film. Go ahead.
Next question.
Yeah, quickly, want to plug the Video Mashups panel tomorrow, similar or related issue tomorrow, 5 p.m. Just a hypothetical question for YouTube. YouTube finds out they just made a boatload of money, advertising money, out of a clip that was uploaded by a person who did not own the copyright. What does YouTube do? Do they keep the money? Do they share the money with the original copyright?
That's a good question. Unlikely to happen because there's not advertising running on unlicensed stuff. So that's the quick, easy answer. To be in a situation like that, what would we do? The first thing I think you do is turn to the person who uploaded the thing and see if they have made, you know, all the promises that they were supposed to make when they uploaded it. And then you go about looking at who harmed from it and how you can make that situation better. Whether that means turning over the money or, I don't know. It's pretty hypothetical though. So I'd have to, it'd be a hard one too. We'd have to, talk about it for a while, I'm afraid.
Hi. I'm an art student in Chicago, and one of the conversations we often have in class is what sort of effect it would have on musicians if iPods no longer had restrictions to share between users. Is that does that worry a lot of people, or are you still confident that the consumer is aware enough and wants their money to go back to the musician that there wouldn't be an abuse of sharing among people, but on a larger scale, if iPod were to sell hardware that didn't have those barriers on it?
Well, I mean, firstly, I'd say that it's kind of not an issue simply because every peer-to-peer program out there scrubs your hard drive and shares everything that's on your hard drive before it hits your iPod. So that music is already being amply shared. In France, 30% of the internet bandwidth is a P2P app called eDonkey. So 30% of internet usage is sharing. So I don't really see it as an issue. Also, I mean, there's so many programs now, it's kind of trivial to just drag files out of your iPod and share it to somebody else.
Right. So is that...
It's kind of, as far as an iPod goes, it's kind of non-issue. I'm not sure I understand your question. Is it that the iPod is somehow preventing massive copying that's not happening?
Not even the iPod, but any sharing program. Is that a huge problem, as it seems to be among all the students and professors? Like, they have no creative answers and they just say this is a huge problem and we have no idea what to do about it.
Okay, so are you saying that if the DRM on devices were removed, are we worried about that?
Well, that along with sharing programs in general.
I think she's asking, in a world where everyone shares music freely, how did the artists get paid? Is that correct?
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, I think we're already in that world.
Right.
So one thing I'll tell you, that's a really interesting number very people know. The music business is $18 billion a year in sales. And you think that's a really big number until you find out that only $6 billion of that is sales to consumers. $12 billion of that is licensing. So when someone like Britney Spears, only a third of the listeners out there have actually bought it, the other two thirds pirated it, it doesn't matter because the Coke ads that feature her or whatever she gets featured on are right. paid for. And if the more you get in the music business, the more you realize that we're not in the business of selling CDs. We're in the business of creating culture that we then stamp on things, whether it's posters or t-shirts or commercials. And whatever cheap ways we have of manufacturing culture and controlling it, those are ways to make money.
Okay, so just to wrap that up, exposure, visibility, and creating buzz is really the main objective. And then out of that, a lot of the money comes from advertising.
Yeah, pretty much in every business, you've got a business-to-consumer segment and a business-to-business segment,
yeah.
right? And the real money always is business-to-business. That's where right. the bulk of the money is. But all the press, the visibility, the hype is always business-to-consumer. And you just face that.
I gotcha.
Thank you. Just want to leave you with one other thought. So the music industry, the film industry combined don't make half as much money as the fashion industry, the garment industry. It's a $200 billion a year industry where there is no copyright protection for garment design. Think about it. It's all getting it to market. It's turning it around season after season after season. And it's a really interesting juxtaposition against the other creative content industries of music and film.
We got two more questions and then try to wrap it up.
Real quickly on the garment, but there is a big problem with counterfeit garments, right? I mean, so they say.
And they usually ends up being, they defend their trademarks really, really
right,
vigorously.
But it's a Folex that's really crappy or whatever. without getting into the Digital Millennium Copyright Act and all that stuff, whether that's evil or really, really evil.
Side of the you fall on, right?
But you know, like, so why is it? It just baffles me. Why is it that they care about a super low quality, crappy YouTube version of some clip of a movie? You know, when you can get, you know, it's really easy. You can rent it from Netflix. You can go to Blockbuster, whatever. You know, they don't care about that. You know, that's not a big problem. But why is it a big problem to have like a little clip of the movie and it's a copyright violation? You got to take it down. All that kind of. I just don't understand why. You know, why they're so worried about it.
They've manufactured culture and they want to leverage that for money. And here's someone
who's... But if it's more popular, isn't that good for them?
I mean, well, except they're used to charging for that. I mean, you just mentioned Netflix and HBO, you know, and they make money from those things.
But they only make it one time, right?
Yeah, I mean, I know you're asking, why aren't they more enlightened? They don't understand that more popularity will make them more money through these other things. They're just not more enlightened.
Don't they know that there's like a quality difference between a DVD and like YouTube?
Yeah, but they'd much rather that there be, you know, a commercial version of YouTube that they do a license agreement with. In fact, that's what they're doing, right? The YouTube killer that they then control and they make all the ad money and they do everything. And it's just like YouTube, only they have full control over it.
Yeah, or, you know, like the thing on Netflix where you can download movies and like 1 out of 10 people can actually get the movie to play or something. I mean, don't remember what this
look, you're looking at four music companies, soon to be three, who today control 80% of the music business. So you're talking about total monopolies. I mean, monopolies don't want change and they don't want power in other people's hands. I mean, this is old style economics.
We need to move to the last question. Before we do that, I want to plug a party we're having tonight with the Creative Commons and Good. Or having a party. You should come talk to Max or I. Talk to me, not I.
Yeah, you should come.
Talk to either me or I.
Okay, last question.
Or 9 p.m. at Uncle Flirty's on 6th Street if you don't. But come talk to us.
I just wanted to ask, who says that ASCAP and BMI calculate royalties based on record sales, CD sales.
John said that.
There are several books. There's a famous book called The Business of Music that goes through the ASCAP and BMI calculations. They use both different formulas, but both they work on essentially a points basis. And the way they track your actual broadcast on radio, they track minor artists versus major artists differently, and there's different calculations for that. And I mean, you go to the legal department and get a book on business, and that's well documented.
I work at ASCAP.
Okay.
And the distribution formula, it's not. There's nothing about record sales in that.
Okay. What I read, and you know the book I'm talking about, The Business of Music?
This business of music.
That's right. And maybe I'm confusing it with BMI then, that has the two-tier system.
I can't speak to BMI.
Okay. I may be confusing it with BMI then, and I apologize, that has a two-tiered system. I believe it was 120-something thousand records sold, and you're in a different category. For them.
All right. The applicable consent decrees mm-hmm. prevent both ASCAP and BMI from negotiating, administering, and a few other verbs having to do with anything but, you know, performances.
Mm-hmm.
You know, which, you know, record sales is sort of a mechanical.
No, I understand that, but there was at least for in this book, and again, I don't have the book in front of me. They divide major artists versus minor artists based on the scale of their sales, and then track them differently from essentially because of a pre-computer way of tracking. And again,
that'd be news to me. Okay. In fairness, you don't have the book. I don't work in distribution. I'm in marketing.
Okay,
but.
I mean, there is something that's really interesting and I haven't figured out, and maybe you can answer it for me, is when I give these talks in Europe and I talk to European collection societies, the amount of money that the European collection societies gives out is so much higher than gets paid in the US. And you get all these sort of minor musicians making decent livings off their collection society royalties. And I just don't see that in the US and I don't understand why.
They cover more than just performing rights, right?
That's it.
That's it.
Yeah.
Okay.
They have more rights under
but, the But I mean, here we've got more rights too, but then it's several agencies and it's just not as efficient.
That's just how the industry evolved here for reasons beyond the scope of the discussion.
I just had one last thing I wanted to do while we had this remarkable audience here. Because we're a startup creative company and, you know, so much of it is how do we use sharing to get people to know about us? I think that's a lot of the really amazing potential for this. And so I'm curious how many of you had heard of Good Magazine before this conference? Okay. So like this is like, wow, that's pretty high. But we're creating videos and we're really excited to put them up on YouTube and other places because it's an amazing way to reach out to creatives like people here and on the film side. And have people find out about us. So it's interesting to see that. But Lindsay Utz, who makes our videos, is out there, and so we're trying to come up with ideas to create things that people will find out about. But anyhow, thanks.
All right, thanks for coming. Thank you.